Let's look at a couple of passages here. Six or eight lines from the bottom of page 15, Socrates says to Glaucon, "And in truth, justice is, it seems, something of this sort. However, it isn't concerned with someone's doing his own externally, but with what is inside him, with what is truly himself and his own. One who is just does not allow any part of himself to do the work of another part, or allow the various classes within him to meddle with each other, the various parts of the soul. Each part does its part, no part tries to usurp the role of the other. He regulates well what is really his own and rules himself. He puts himself in order, is his own friend, and harmonizes the three parts of himself like three limiting notes in a musical scale, high, low, and middle. He binds together those parts and any others there may be in between." So there is the possibility of other parts here, right? The soul isn't just these things, but for our purposes it is, for the purposes of the analogy. "And from having been many things, he becomes entirely one, moderate and harmonious. Only then does he act. And when he does anything, whether acquiring wealth, which is certainly fine for some, taking care of his body, engaging in politics, or in private contracts, in all of these he believes that the action is just and fine, that preserves this inner harmony and helps achieve it. It calls it so, and regards as wisdom the knowledge that oversees such actions. And he believes that the action that destroys this harmony is unjust, and calls it so, and regards the belief that oversees it as ignorance." On the next page over, on 17, which is on the right-hand side of that sheet you're looking at, about eight lines from the top, Socrates says, "Virtue seems, then, to be a kind of health, fine condition, and well-being of the soul, while vice is disease, shameful condition, and weakness." So virtue is well-being, which is what we're all searching for. Ultimately, Plato argues that all the virtues require one another, that you can't be courageous and foolish at the same time. And the linchpin that holds them all together is going to be wisdom. So ultimately, wisdom is equivalent to well-being, Plato. Or justice. I mean, it's a single whole with many faces. This is what well-being is. And the virtues are the many faces of it, if you will. And you refer to the whole by referring to any one of its parts. But when you talk about righteousness, you're trying to sort of sum up the whole. Another term that Aristotle uses to try and sum up the whole of virtue is magnanimity, or greatness of soul. And then he goes on a little further down where it says 445 in the margin. "So it now remains, it seems, to inquire whether it is more profitable to act justly, live in a fine way, and be just, whether one is known to be so or not, or to act unjustly and be unjust, provided that one doesn't pay the penalty and become better as a result of punishment." He's got to now deal with the issue, that the challenge that's been given to him. Are you better off being just, even if you're punished for it, than a person who's unjust and rewarded? And we have this passage that starts at the bottom of 17. He gives the answer to that challenge. Basically, what he does is, at the bottom of page 18, there's a nice passage here, about nine lines from the bottom. Socrates, first of all, he says, let's craft an image of the soul, of the three parts of the soul. And the three parts of the soul are described this way. Reason is described as a human part, a human being, whereas spiritedness is described as a kind of combination of lion and snake. Lions are very proud beasts, but there's also the sort of petty, carping quality of spirited people. They can be contentious and difficult to deal with, right? And so the snake is symbolic of that. And then the desires are represented by a multi-headed beast, a sort of mythical beast with every possible ravenous, drooling set of jaws you can possibly imagine. Because desire can be infinite. It can be, especially with a fertile imagination, you can come to invest your interest in virtually anything. To appreciate how protean desire is, how plastic it is, and how implicitly infinite it is, just go through a supermarket one day and begin to contemplate everything there with the dirtiest possible thoughts in your mind. It's already happening. Everyone starts smiling as they visualize themselves in the fruits and vegetables and the breads and things like that. But the point is that it's possible to take sexual desires and attach them to anything. There's just the most amazing array of fetishes that people have. Why is that? Well, because there's something protean about desire. And if you have a sufficiently active and dirty mind, you can be turned on by anything. You can want anything. And this is why this image of a kind of multi-headed beast with many drooling, snapping pairs of jaws is perfectly reasonable as an image of desire, because unmoderated, it becomes that way. Okay, so imagine these three things and then all fused together into some very bizarre-looking chimerical kind of being, you know, a sort of mythical being with many different heads and parts. So at the bottom of 18, he says, Socrates says, then if someone maintains that injustice profits this human being, and that doing just things brings no advantage, let's tell him that he is simply saying that it is beneficial for him first to feed the multiform beast well and make it strong, and also the lion and all that pertains to him. Second, to starve and weaken the human being within, so that he is dragged along wherever either of the two heads of the other two leads. And third, to leave parts to bite and kill one another rather than accustoming them to each other and making them friendly. Okay. This is what it means to say that you're benefited by injustice. To say that you're benefited by injustice is to say that you are benefited by stoking your desires up and attaching them to an infinite array of abnormal and perverse objects. Becoming fanatical about small issues of pride and things like this, and then having your desires and your pride constantly fighting with one another, fighting with other people, and to starve that human part of you, the most distinctly human part, your reason, and to weaken it so that it can't rule over the other two and can't introduce harmony amongst the other two. Now, is a person like that, who's ravenously hungry at all times, who's always pursuing things and never can be satisfied, who's contentious and quarrelsome over petty and small things, who swells with pride over things that he hasn't achieved, these are the kinds of perversions of the spirited part of the soul. The narcissistic person seems in some ways to be ruled by a kind of absence of self-worth, which gives them a constant concern with affirmation and respect, right? Imagine being this kind of person, Socrates says. Is this really beneficial? Because that's what injustice means in the soul. And we all come across people like this. People who can never be satisfied with anything. People who are always suspicious, always concerned with pecking orders, always concerned with real and imagined slights. We're always looking for affirmation and don't care if it's they're being affirmed for things that they've done or things that they just pretend to do or things that other people have done and they've taken credit for. We've all known people like this, and they're not happy. Even though they might be rewarded for these kinds of behaviors and made president of the United States or whatever. I mean, we know people like this. Whereas the reverse, the person who's just, he says, at the top of 19, let's just look at there. But on the other hand, wouldn't someone who maintains that just things are profitable be saying, first, that all our words and deeds should ensure that the human being within this human being, because the human being within the human being is reason within the larger soul, right? Reason within the larger soul. That the human being within this human being has the most control. Second, that he should take care of the many-headed beast as a farmer does his animals, feeding and domesticating the gentle heads and preventing the savage ones from growing. This is how we take care of our desires. We feed and domesticate them, and we extirpate the savage ones. Right? And this is how you deal with kids, right? Your kids start beating up the neighbor kids and stealing their toys. You extirpate those desires, those savage desires, and you try and encourage and cultivate and domesticate the gentler and more humane ones. And third, that he should make the lion's nature his ally, care for the community of all his parts, and bring them up in such a way that they will be friends with each other and with himself. Isn't this what you're saying by saying that virtue, or wisdom, or justice is a benefit to you? It's the health of the soul. And what could be more beneficial than that? And then he goes on and he gives more examples, and he's really quite eloquent. Below the center, page 19, he's saying now, addressing the person who believes that injustice is beneficial, he says, right at the center of 19, then let's persuade him gently, for he isn't wrong of his own will, by asking him these questions. Should we say that this is the original basis for the conventions about what is fine and what is shameful? Fine things are those that subordinate the beast-like parts of our nature to the human, or better, perhaps, to the divine. Shameful ones are those that enslave the gentle to the savage. Aren't the shameful things, by convention, the things that take our gentle nature and make us more savage, whereas aren't the fine things the things that take our savage nature and subordinate it to the gentle? If you think about things that are conventionally held to be fine versus base, that's fairly true. Things like, here's an example, gentlemanliness. The whole model of gentlemanliness, which is very central to the Greeks. All of this is trying to subordinate the savage to the fine. In light of this argument, can it profit anyone to acquire gold unjustly if by doing so he enslaves the best part of himself to the most vicious? If he got the gold by enslaving his son or daughter to savage and evil men, it wouldn't profit him, no matter how much gold he got. How then could he fail to be wretched if he pitilessly enslaves the most divine part of himself to the most godless and polluted one, and accepts golden gifts in return for the most terrible destruction, or a more terrible destruction than Eriphiles when she took the necklace in return for her husband's soul? In sum, it's a purely internal notion of harmony that Plato thinks is completely enough for happiness, for well-being. Well, he talks about imagination in places. It doesn't seem to fit in this map. Right? Where does the imagination? Well, the dark parts of the soul have everything to do with the desires. That's an interesting question. That sort of brings us to the Taoists, which we'll deal with, believe me. We'll get to that. But first of all, what motivates reason to do its work? Well, that's a good point. The division of the soul into the rational, the spirited, the desiring parts, it's a kind of static, cross-sectional analysis of the soul at one particular point in life, and you'll see these parts at all times. But you can also give a kind of dynamic analysis to the soul, its processes of unfolding and maturation over time. And when Plato gives this kind of dynamic analysis of the energies of the soul, the term he uses for that is eros, or love. He uses it in the same way that Freud uses it. Freud was quite explicit about how he used love. You know, everyone said, Freud, oh, he's just this dirty old man. He thinks that everything's about sex. And he says, no, I don't think that everything's about sex because I don't think that sex is about sex. Eros has a broader meaning than simply sex, that it refers to the entire energy of the soul and its forward thrust towards some kind of self-actualization. Plato, actually, in the Republic, he doesn't explicitly do this, but if you read it carefully, you find where he talks about how each part of the soul has its love. Reason has a love of wisdom. And what philosophy is precisely the love of wisdom. It doesn't need a motivation, an extrinsic motivation, in the sense that it already has a kind of forward thrust. But this forward thrust is towards that which satisfies it. And so reason has an erotic longing to get to the bottom of things and to know the truth. Now, there are some truths that are more important than others. And you do need extrinsic rewards to be concerned with nematodes and things like that. But there are certain things that are intrinsically of interest, right? These things do not require any bribes or extrinsic rewards to become interested in. Once you're aware of them, you become curious. And the Greeks were great advocates and observers of the natural curiosity of man. And philosophy, Aristotle says, begins in wonder. You just wonder about certain things. And this wonder is an awareness of an emptiness in us and a kind of, if you will, erotic longing for that thing which will fulfill that need. He talks about how the spirit loves honor. It has a love, an erotic longing for honor, for ideals, for recognition, things like that. And the same with the desires. The desires love money. But the desires have their loves too, and one of the things that they love is, well, sex. Right? But again, you know, for Plato, Eros isn't all sex. And neither was it for Freud. So the reason why, you know, reason functions is that it has a longing to function. It's a biological capacity, in some sense, that unfolds over time and has a kind of internal thrust. And if you want to call that a desire, you can. But one has to recognize that the difference between the higher and the lower desires are in terms of their objects, right? And that the desires of the higher faculty of the soul are things like truth, or ideals, honor. Whereas the desires is specifically to the necessities of life. Food, clothing, shelter. Now, there are subtleties that are introduced into the scheme. For instance, how do you explain the desire for a Lexus? Okay? That can't be understood in terms of the necessities of life. If it's necessary to get from point A to B, you could buy a Yugo. Why do people spend all that extra money? Well, it has things to do with spiritedness. Prestige. The love of luxury. Plato thinks that luxury is more an interest of the spirit than of the desiring part of the soul. And if you look at pre-modern societies, which again, we're far more interested in luxury than we are in some ways. The average person had far fewer luxuries, but the whole order was more oriented towards them. Think of a society like Tibet, where what percentage of the population were monks and nuns? Like 40%? 40% of the population was celibate and spent their time praying. Now, this is a luxury, you'd have to say, for any society to support 40% of its population in what, from the point of view of good, hard-headed, practical considerations, would have to be considered idleness. These people are idle. They spent a lot of their surplus, virtually all of their surplus money, on building monasteries and copying books and painting things. You know, you look at the ancient Egyptians. What's more luxurious than piling up pyramids? It's a complete waste from any practical point of view. They weren't very effective or practical with keeping Pharaoh's body secure after death. In fact, somebody's hypothesized they might not have been used for that, which I find extremely exciting, because the idea that they were entirely useless or had no earthly use is extremely appealing to me. Most pre-modern societies are luxury-oriented in the sense that they're oriented towards activities that don't serve any earthly purpose, building the cathedrals of the Middle Ages, things like that. And again, people who try and give a materialistic or self-interested explanation for most human behaviors are in a real bind. Marvin Harris is this Marxist anthropologist who, I think, if he's still alive, he was at Columbia for a long time. He has a number of books in the vein of cultural materialism. It's Marxism applied in anthropology. And he tries to explain everything in terms of practical considerations. Why do the Indians let people starve but won't eat the cows that walk through the streets? Stuff like that. Why did the Aztecs spend so much time having wars and cutting open the chests of their captives instead of putting these people to work? Go ahead.
Does Plato have any opinion or thoughts of this archetype, you know, that Jungian had, with like the fool or the king or the warrior?
Well, I mean, Plato certainly talks about archetypes, and there are interesting parallels between someone like Plato and Jung. I think Jung, you know, moves interestingly as he developed his thought towards a position that's quite metaphysical, really quite Platonic in this sense. Plato argues that the soul already knows everything that's important, yet we're not aware of it. And he's not just saying that there's an individual, if you will, unconscious. There's a kind of collective unconscious for Plato in the sense that this is the realm of the ideas or forms, right? Which we approach through articulating a kind of unconscious knowledge that we have. And he tells some likely stories about how that could be the case. He argues that the soul exists before birth in this realm of forms, and then it enters the body and forgets them, and then has to struggle through life to be reminded of these things and to articulate them, and that what philosophy is preeminently is this process of bringing to the surface and articulating what the soul already knows. Right? Now, Jung has a different views of how the archetypes work in the psyche, and he constantly treats them as living forces, right, that can somehow take control of people. People get possessed by certain archetypes and things like that. I don't quite know what to think of that. I mean, in some ways it's obviously true when you see people sort of acting out roles and you wonder, why are they doing this? You know, they do seem to be in the grip of certain images or ideas that have somehow gotten into their heads or have always been there. Plato doesn't treat the forms that way. So there's a kind of metaphysical similarity, but when you get to accounts of the dynamics of the psyche, he really doesn't have the same kind of account of the role of archetypes that someone like Jung would have. But they do both have this notion of a realm of ideas, and I mean the word paradigm in Greek is equivalent to what archetype. I mean they mean the same thing.
Yeah.
the forms, paradigms, archetypes, forms, models, they all mean the same thing. And Plato would have understood a lot of what Jung was saying, but ultimately they don't say the same things about them. Someone like Hobbes, who's one of the great founders of modernity, gives us a picture of life that's very different. He says, felicity, which is what we were calling happiness or well-being, is the continual progress of the desires from one object to another that ceases only in death. And as one commentator put, Hobbes invented the rat race. Okay? You know, I've got a big house, but I need a bigger house. Why? Because my income has grown and I need a bigger mortgage so I can have bigger tax write-offs, and it just never ends. It's this endless upward escalator that a lot of people are on. I like a world with lots of variety in it. And I like the idea that, say, the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire have all this stuff. They're great art collectors and have lots of property and so forth. And there are certain excellences that come into the world because of the enormous acquisitiveness of wealthy people. Right? They have lots of stuff. They commission things from artists and so forth. And they might be quite actualized by living this life of patrons of the arts and conservers of tradition and things like that. Personally, I would find it, and this sounds also convenient since I don't have these things, but personally, I would find it extremely burdensome to be as wealthy as these people are. They are phenomenally wealthy. Chatsworth House in England is just a vast museum. And they basically are just sort of curators and caretakers of the mountains of stuff that 14 or 15 generations of their ancestors have managed to put together. And, of course, they add their little bit to it. And as each generation goes on, the snowball gets bigger and bigger and bigger, bearing down on the next generation below. But they create certain things that are quite excellent. And if you're that kind of person who's up to it, you know, why not? There are other kinds of people who are less temperamentally suited to the burden of property, right? I'm that way, which is very fortunate for me. I will totally grant the idea that some people are happy with lots of stuff, okay? I would also, however, want to say that these people should be, well, put it this way, I would also want to make the point that many people with lots of stuff are not those kinds of people, and that that there's something in this for them that they could change, or they could find that they would be happier if they were less acquisitive. We have a civilization that's centered around acquisitiveness, and it's just not for everybody. I tend to worry a lot about the meager possessions that I have. You know, if I had a lot more, I would worry a lot more. But there are other people who are more extroverted and more thing-oriented and are more actualized with those things. And again, there are certain kinds of excellences that can exist in a world where there are no people who have lots of stuff. If you look at the history of high culture, most of it has come into existence as the result of the patronage of fabulously wealthy people. I'm glad that these people exist. These people couldn't have done it if they had chosen the life of Socrates. So I'm glad they're out there. And if they were up to the task, you know, they apparently were, so much the better. However, it's not for everybody, but there is this individualized thing, and it has everything to do with temperament. Some people are more temperamentally suited for this, others aren't. But even given that there's a variation of temperament, there can be too much. There could be too much even for the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire. There could be too much for Bill Gates or the Sultan of Brunei to talk about some really rich people. Yeah, you don't have to convince me. I'm no communist. I'm not a great admirer of consumerism or capitalism in many ways, but in principle, I think there is just an enormous variety of human types. And the idea that you can have a kind of off-the-rack, one-size-fits-all life for every human being is foolish as a theory, and should have been dismissed after a couple seconds of consideration, and has been monstrous whenever people have tried to practice it throughout history. People will sort themselves out, if left free, into different classes of people. Some people will have more, and some people will have less. And the ideal situation is to have a society where you're not assigned to this by some arbitrary fiat, but where you migrate to a position or a life because of your affinity for it. I mean, that's the only issue.